and even more straining on my system to do that, that I've actually gotten sick from that. And so, you know, just like, whatever. So, interestingly, though, is that what has happened is a shift not knowing what anything is for and allowing myself to be open and allow the Spirit to speak through me, a shift has happened to where I'm back to fixing the world, fixing the problem where it doesn't exist. So it's the reverse of the miracle process, even though for all intents and purposes, as far as I'm concerned, it's a miracle, you know, but it's not, you know, because I'm actually strengthening the belief in lack. I'm strengthening that by thinking from that perspective. And so this is huge, this part. It's very huge, you know. And I have definitely gone through this so many times, I can't even begin to even count how many times this has happened. Where, you know, because back and forth and back and forth. And this last thing I'll say is, it's partly because of wanting so badly to be of service and buying into the apparent lack or suffering of the other person, I would trigger how I agree with it on some level in myself because I'm seeing it, I've projected it, and misunderstood why I'm there. Understood. And so it's really important to constantly, whenever I open my mouth, to say, talk to me and through me, and stay tuned for how I feel while I'm saying what I'm saying and get out of the way. It's just a very, very important part to me. So thank you for letting me share that.
Well, you're very welcome, Lisa. And yes, I would just repeat what you said, that this is hugely important. It's also a theme, the theme of you must ask, that's repeated and repeated and repeated. And rather few of the repetitions survive the editing, which itself is an interesting point. So that emphasis, which is so clear in the material as it was originally given to Helen, tends to evaporate or be attenuated, so it's much less conspicuous as the editing proceeded. Yeah, we've got to ask. The whole process of miracle-mindedness and atonement is a direct personal interaction between ourselves and Jesus. And he'll tell us what we need to know, when we need to know it. And if we're running off on our own strength, on our own cleverness, well, Casey is a good example. We may be very well intentioned indeed, but what comes out is not very good. All right, Deborah, I think we're now at the top of page 19, T1B30H, and I'll post that link one more time.
First of all, can I be heard? Can you hear me? Good. Hi, babe. I remember you from last time. Before I was due, and of course, I don't know if I mentioned this one, I may have, but it was a very powerful experience to me, very mind-opening to me, and it was during a break apart from my partner and I, and Doug, do you mind me going into the theater right now?
No, no.
The children may have an agenda. Okay. I had, we were splitting, and he was carrying a lot of tension and emotional energy in his shoulders, and he was literally bending over to a 90 degree angle. Honestly, as he was walking, he was getting right down to that degree, and I knew nothing about energy work. Nothing about anything, but I had a small feeling of compassion coming through me, and I wanted to rub his shoulders to see if that would assist. That was not something he liked, like any kind of touch like that. And I asked him, do you want me to rub your shoulders? Should I massage your shoulders? And he said, sure. So he sat down at the table, and the only way he could sit there was leaning his head on his arms on the table, and I stood behind him, rubbing his, massaging his shoulder. feel energy coming up my arm and into my chest, and it didn't go out. It just kept building up and building up and building up, and I felt like I had a balloon inside and this thing is going to burst. And so I had been spoken to numerous times previous to this prayer trip, and I said in my head, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what to do. And as soon as I said that, a voice very clearly spoke and said, that's his pain and for him to deal with. So I immediately took my hands away, just whipped them away, thinking I'm doing something wrong. And when I did that, all the energy from my heart, my chest area, just went zoomed in from my arm, right back, right out of my arm. It was like I could almost see this lightning bolt effect. And it flew into him, and it hit him. By the way, he had been straightening up himself into a sitting position as the energy came through him to me. And he flew forward and started to cry. He had a huge catharsis. So I'm taking that in this moment that this, I was being spoken to that I, had I carried on, it would have been an error to one thing, receiving it and taking it in myself, and it was happening that way because I was doing something incorrectly, and I could ask for guidance on what to do, not think. I could do this massage shoulders here, what to do. Carmen, I'll pass this on to you. Here's the mic.
Can you hear me? Can anybody hear me? Oh, thank you. Okay. I don't see her in the room. Thank you. This is such an important topic, and the little story that I used to illustrate this part of the Urtec from which we're extending in our group. This is such a key point that I think it's worth spending a little bit of extra time on, at least some of these personal stories, like what Deborah just shared, which is absolutely a perfect example of it. This is just such a dramatic example that it really drove the point home for me, and I'm sure it's a lot of people, and it seems to have a lot of impact. So I thank you for your patience in allowing me to share it. This friend of ours, Penny, is a country and western singer, but she's also, of course, in the forest community, and she's very spiritual, so she was at a some sort of a spiritual, what is she doing for? We're studying A Course in Miracles here. But anyway, Penny was at this concert. It was a spiritual concert, and there was a huge crowd of people, several thousand people in front of the bandstand. And Penny was off to the side waiting for her turn to go on. And she witnessed this event where this biker gentleman stood up. Not a gentleman, that's not the word that she would use to describe him. But he's a Hell's Angel. And all of this spirituality that was going on in the group was just, he was bringing his pain to a crucial head. And he stood up and he started screaming at the top of his lungs that he was going to hell, and that he knew it, that he murdered people, and that even Jesus couldn't forgive him. And Penny's heart just went out to this man, and she was, you know, her first impulse was to go out there off the stage and grab this man and just tell him how much he was loved and how much Jesus forgave everything, and that there was no crime, that it was all just an illusion, it's all in the past, and so on. And instead, something held her back, and she just hesitated for a moment. It just didn't feel like the right thing to do. And when she hesitated, at exactly that moment, this Hell's Angel was surrounded by a group of bikers for Christ, who are, you know, just one notch up from Hell's Angels, I suppose. But anyway, they started talking to him about being washed in the blood of Jesus, which is not the way anybody in the first community would try to describe forgiveness, but it was the language that man could hear. And it reduced him to tears, and he fell into the arms of these other bikers, and the voice in Penny's head said to her, "With all of your wisdom, could you have done that?" And when she shared that story with me, I went, okay, God says that he provides voices who can speak to all of his children in a language that they can understand. And that's what this is telling us, is that we can send that prayer to the Holy Spirit when we see someone in pain, and just release it to spirit, and it's healed in us and them. And it may not be us that does the actual contact with them, that God will send the perfect person, or the perfect group of people in this instance. And that's why it's not for us to judge. Everybody has somebody right there, but when they're ready, spirit moves that perfect person through the perfect way of language for the level of understanding of that person. Our truth feels like a tap to the guy on the street, the standard Christian, the standard mainstream religious person of any kind. Unless somebody asks us for help, and even then we need to ask, should we help this person? Should we ask the right person to come to this person's help? Because what we understand may seem very, very fear-inducing to other people. And the Holy Spirit cannot use a person in fear. He cannot help a person by giving them even more fear. It pushes them back. And we have to get our egos out of the way. Sometimes Jesus says we have to be willing to say, no, I can't help you, but I'm going to pray that the right person who can help you shows up for you. So I just wanted to share that. So I'm giving you the microphone, and thank you so much for your question.
Well, thank you, Carmen, for that. That is, I think, a superb illustration of the principle being discussed here. Not only should you ask, but you're going to hear when you do, and Jesus knows better than any of us know, what's appropriate for whom, when. And this reminds me of a line we read a few weeks ago back in T1B18. It's from the notes, it's not in the air text. You should live so that God is free to arrange temporary human constellations as he sees fit. Now, there was a temporary human constellation that Carmen was just talking about that was arranged utterly perfectly in an obviously perfect kind of way. Magnificent. And if anybody else has an illustration or a story or a comment, feel free to raise your hand. Otherwise, I think we're now at the top of page 19, T1B38.
Okay, can you hear me? Anybody? Thanks. I'm feeling after reading this, when I immerse myself in it and go through my history, that I was probably in just sitting in healing circles and just allowing spirit to arrange who should be there and watch the show and then take the guidance in, because it feels to me still that I may miss something, and I guess I just don't want to feel awkward. I'll go on with the reading here. 30H. And we are on page 19. The answer is never perform a miracle without asking me if you should. This spares you from exhaustion, and because you act under direct communication, the trance becomes unnecessary. Because miracles are expressions of love, it does not follow that they will always be effective. I am the only one who can perform miracles indiscriminately because I am the atonement. Doug?
All right, I was pushing my hand up there in advance because it's usually delayed. I'll read the last sentence there, which I also want to comment on. Jesus says, I am the only one who can perform miracles indiscriminately because I am the atonement. You have a role in atonement. You have a role in atonement, which I will dictate to you. So here we have again the theme of asking. Never perform a miracle without asking me if you should. Implied, asking first. This spares you exhaustion because you're acting under direct communication. And then this additional explanation, because or just because miracles are expressions of love, it does not follow they will always be effective. And then, I am the only one who can perform miracles indiscriminately because I am the atonement. And by indiscriminate, this refers to previous discussion about miracles. Oh, I can't actually remember what I was going to say there. I am the only one who can perform miracles indiscriminately because I am the atonement. Which suggests, or directly states, that Jesus has a role that is specific and particular in the atonement. He is the atonement. And you and I, by extension, have a role in the atonement which he will dictate to us. And that role, obviously, we need to listen to him to find out what role we should be playing at any moment. And unless we ask, literally, unless we ask, we're not listening. Now that asking doesn't necessarily need to be a formal sit down and say, okay, please Jesus, tell me. Clearly in the two examples that Deborah and Carmen just offered, there was an asking in the sense of an open heart willing to hear, without any formal process of asking, except Deborah, I think you did say that you actually asked about what was going on and if you should continue, and got the answer at the point you asked. Okay, that's the end of that paragraph. On to the next, T1B through the I.
Yeah, Doug, I did ask and I got an answer immediately, but it was that was his pain and that's for him to deal with, so that wasn't sort of telling me, I guess that's what I needed to do at that moment, was disconnect, so that was clear enough that way, but it still left a lot of issue for me in that. And it's taken me years to say no to people when they're asking me to do for them. That is a very difficult area, I find, and it's a really sensitive area. So it's how to address that in a way that the other person can hear, and in the way that the other person doesn't feel that it's a withdrawal of love. Am I being heard? Yeah. Okay. So I'll leave it at that, unless someone has something to add to it, and carry on with reading at 30i. Thanks. Remember, you already have a point about the involuntary nature of miracles. You also have established the fact that everything involuntary belongs under Christ's control, not under yours. Under Christ's control, miracles replenish the doer as well as the receiver. Well, I was replenished. I mean, nothing was taken away in that situation. 30J. Possession really means not under Christ's control, thus making him, bracket, the mind, question mark, something's not, or something's missing, close bracket, vulnerable to projection. The references to the earthbound entering bodies really refer to the taking over by their own earthbound thoughts. This is demon possession. After all, Lucifer fell, but he was still an angel. He is thus the symbol for man. Atonement is the knowledge that the belief that angels can fall is false. It is true that mind can create projections as well as miracles, but it's not true that projections are real. Any psychologist should understand this. This is what is meant by the truth shall set you free. There's a mic, Doug.
Ah, there we are. Okay. Couple of points here. In the previous paragraph, under Christ's control, miracles replenish the doer as well as the receiver. That's a key piece of information. If what's going on is not replenishing, if it is draining, if it is strained, if it is stressful, you can be almost sure that this is not a miracle that's been guided. And now we get into this fascinating discussion of possession, demon possession, Lucifer's fall, and a number of potentially very fearful ideas. And I think it's really important to stress some of the explanations being offered. Possession really means not under Christ's control, which makes the mind vulnerable to projection. And whenever we're not asking, we are essentially possessed by earthbound thoughts. And that is demon possession, we're told. Which is a really fascinating notion. When we're not operating under Christ's control, when we're not asking, when we're not doing what we're told, we are literally possessed by our own earthbound thoughts, which are projections and unhelpful, to say the least. And then we're reminded that projections aren't real. And some of the, well, I think we can just go on this one, because Jesus explains it, I think, better than I can in the next paragraph. Go ahead, Deborah.
Can you hear me? Christ controlled miracles are part of the atonement, but Christ's guidance is personal and leads to personal salvation. The impersonal nature of miracles is an essential ingredient, because this enables me to control their distribution as I see fit. Christ's guidance, on the other hand, leads to the highly personal experience of revelation. This is why it involves personal choice. A guide does not control, by definition, but he does direct, leaving the following up to you. Lead us not into temptation, lead us out of our own errors. Note that the word is lead, not order. Here you go, Mike. Here you go, Doug.
We have here an introduction to the themes of Christ's guidance versus Christ's control, which will be expanded upon later. And so I think I'll wait for the expansion before pursuing that further. But I want to note the distinction here between impersonal and personal, and the reference to the highly personal experience of revelation. Miracles are generally of an impersonal nature. We're told the impersonal nature of miracles is an essential ingredient, because it enables Jesus to control their distribution as he sees fit. But there's another kind of connection going on here, which is highly personal, a specifically personal connection between a human individual and Jesus. And this is associated with Christ's guidance rather than Christ's control. And this personal nature of the connection that is possible between anyone and Jesus is another theme that tended to get edited out in subsequent abridgments of the Course, but is significantly stressed at a number of points in the material as Helen first took it down. And it's not just stressed in statements like these, we actually see examples where Helen recounts her own very personal revelation experiences with Jesus that were not, quote, part of the Course, unquote, in the sense of being part of the formal dictation, but provide, I think, an excellent example of what is meant by the personal connection, personal guidance, personal communication, intimate personal exchange between oneself and Jesus. And this is summarized with note that the word is lead, not order. These revelatory experiences, these personal communications, are not something that are imposed on us. The same way as instructions are not imposed on us. We have to ask. We have to open, we have to invite that kind of communication. And we have here one of a number of quotes from the Bible which Jesus then offers us an explanation or interpretation that's quite different from some of the more common interpretations we might hear. Lead us not into temptation, from the Lord's Prayer, means guide us out of our own errors. Guide us, not order. All right.
Okay, so 30M. Take up thy cross and follow me should be interpreted to read, recognize your errors and choose to abandon them by following my guidance. 30N. Brackett, tell Bill when he is afraid of possession, he need only remember that error cannot really threaten truth, which always can withstand its assaults. Only the error is really vulnerable, close bracket. The princes of this world are the princes only because they are really angels, but they are free to establish their kingdom where they be fit. Care to come out? Doug?
I just lost my place here. Well, we see here a reference to Bill's fear of possession. And this is discussed elsewhere. And in the context of the distinction between control and guidance. The reference to princes of this world is a reference to 1 Corinthians 2:6, where Paul writes, howbeit we speak wisdom among them that are perfect, yet not the wisdom of this world, nor of the princes of this world that came to naught, which is, I presume, an attempt to explain that passage in Corinthians, as we have an explanation of take up your cross and follow me from Mark 10. Just above, should be interpreted to read, recognize your errors and choose to abandon them by following my guidance. There's a series of biblical quotes in this segment which are given interpretations in this way. Now, I'm not really sure myself what princes of this world means or what its relevance to this is, except that it might be connected to the idea of fear of possession, demons, immaterial spirits operating, and an attempt to appease certain fears on that topic. I'm not really sure on that one. So we're now at the top of page 20, and we're getting into some more material from the notes that's not in the third text. All right, take it away, Deborah.
And Carmen writes up here, we are the princes of this world in that we rule it. Carmen, do you care to expand on that a bit?
Okay, he's talked about Lucifer and the fact that he's a perfect symbol for us and that angels cannot fall. And then he goes back to the princes of the world are really princes because they're angels. And they haven't really fallen. The best interpretation of that our study group can come up with after working with this material for almost a decade is what he's implying is that Bill is afraid of being possessed by some sort of outside evil, like an alien entity that possesses this evil dynamic that rules the world, when in truth is each and every one of us has that component of the ego in us, which collectively is what Jesus describes as the devil. But the truth of the matter is that we are the princes of this world. We have collectively agreed to the rules that have shaped this physical dimension that we live in. We're actually ruling it, but we think we're victims of it. And we're seeing ourselves as possessed or prisoners of this world, when in truth, we're its creator. And so we're actually ruling it by our agreement and adding the power of our individual mind to the collective agreement. And that's the best understanding that we've come to as a group, so I thought I'd ask it. But thanks for asking for the explanation. I hope it might help. Thank you.
Thanks, Carmen. There's a lot that's helping me right now. And I just want to say that reading through this, as I'm reading this, it's like I'm on a roller coaster, my God. And then this next little 30-0 is sort of bringing me down to a peaceful place again. 30-0, if you will remember that all princes inherit their power from the Father, the right choice becomes inevitable. So there's great peace in that one. As long as I don't muck it up. Okay, 30-0 and 1. The soul is in the state of grace forever. 30-0 and 2. Man's reality is only his soul. Uh-huh. 30-0 and 3. Therefore, man is in a state of grace forever. 30-P. Atonement undoes all errors in this respect, and thus uproots the real source of fear. If you will check back at the reference to uprooting, you will understand it better in this context. 30Q. Bracket, tell Bill that whenever God's reassurances are explained as threat, it is always because man is defending his misplaced and misdirected love and loyalty. That is what projection always involves. Close bracket. Take it away, Doug.
Okay. In the previous paragraph, we're getting a reference back to a previous mention of uprooting, which had to do with, I believe, Bill expressing a certain discomfort, feeling that he was being, his whole system of thought was being uprooted. And the subsequent paragraph, tell Bill that whenever God's reassurances are experienced as threat, it is always because man is defending his misplaced love and loyalty. So, one of the things that many students of the Course and many people pursuing other mystical traditions as well have experienced is a certain vertigo, disorientation, feeling like they're literally being uprooted from everything they think is real and true. And yeah, that's exactly what happens. But the atonement in undoing all errors and reminding us that we are in a state of grace forever is actually uprooting the real source of fear, which is the belief that that's not true. So this particular theme of uprooting or disorientation comes up a number of times in the first chapter, because both Helen and Bill are experiencing it. And Helen is told that old things have to be unlearned to make room for new learning. And obviously enough, if one is built a world on illusions, something has to come undone before it can be redone. The errors, when an error is undone, something goes. And if we have believed in those errors, we will feel a little bit of shock and uncertainty as we see them come apart. Okay. So that brings us to 30p. No, it brings us to 30q. No, it brings us to 30r, casting spells. All right, we're getting towards the bottom of page 21 now. P1B30R.
Casting spells merely means affirming error, and error is lack of love. When man projects this onto others, he does imprison them, but only to the extent that he reinforces errors they have already made. This distortion makes them vulnerable to the curse of others, since they have already cursed themselves. The miracle worker can only bless, and this undoes the curse and frees the soul from prison. We go to.
Well, again, we're dealing with the theme of sort of black magic, spells, possessions, demons, and I believe that both Bill and Helen had been reading Edgar Cayce at the time that the Course Dictation began, and there was some interest in and concern with matters of spirituality and the supernatural and evil forces and whatnot. And we see a lot of reassurances and explanations about these concepts being offered here. So what is casting a spell but affirming an error? An error is a lack of love, but we're told that this can only be done to the extent that it's reinforcing errors that have already been made, and that distortion makes people vulnerable to the curses of others because they've already cursed themselves. But the miracle worker, in contrast, can only bless, which undoes the curse and frees the soul from the prison of earthbound thoughts or errors or lacks of love. Now we got lots of hands going up here. I don't know whose was up first. Whoever was, go for it.
Unless Carmen wants to tackle me. this is an awesome part. I love this. You don't mind tackling me? Okay. I love this part because, you know, the role of the victim in the world is he did this to me, or he rescued me, or he hurt me, or he rescued me, or he hurt me, or on and on it goes. And I had huge experience where I literally turned my power over to another human being. My life, my decision making, everything. And all of this because in the very beginning of meeting this person, he affirmed everything I already was telling myself. Now, this wasn't the truth, but it was surely what I was believing. I had dreams about dying. I was really addicted to, I was bulimic. And this person was telling me, you're going to die. I had, on and on it would go, you know. And whatever insecurities I had, whatever things I believed about myself, that where I wasn't enough or I lacked the ability to make a decision for myself for anything, he affirmed, you know. And as pretty as you please, I walked right into that and ended up with this really crazy world that we just, the two of us, I mean, it was just insane. And afterwards, still being terrified of him, because believing that the power that he had was of him, that he was doing this to me, and that he could hurt me, you know, energy-wise or whatever, that he could hurt me or whatever like that. And only by uprooting the fear of where it really was, the beliefs of what was really going on, the miracle was able to show me that it was only affirming error. All it did was affirm error. I believed this, he co-signed it, and off I went. And so it was really huge. Anyway, thanks. I'd love to hear what Carmen has to say.
I don't know if that's
first is, I got an awful lot of really negative messages when I was growing up, from my mother especially. And it was interesting that I spent 45 years of my life before finding a course, blaming my mother for all of the reasons why I wasn't the person that I knew I had the potential to be. When the course came along, I was really upset that I couldn't blame my mother, that I was responsible for drawing her to me. Literally picked her because she was going to give me the messages. It was the hour and voice of my inner doubt. And that was just huge in my forgiveness of that whole situation of growing up that way. I got an illustration, and I think illustrations of real life examples just really help things get clear to us. And we are able to make it part of our thinking process when we start coming from a new point of view and everything we think. I had a friend who was an alcoholic and he had two sons. And I used to talk to the sons. One went on to become a great success, and the other one was a victim of his parents forever. And I talked to the son who was very successful in the restaurant business, and his younger brother hated him because he had turned into an alcoholic, and he was, you know, practically one step out of the gutter. And he resented his older brother who had made successes with himself. And I asked the brother, I said, what do you think was the difference? He said, we both got the same messages, I just didn't believe them. In fact, he said, I used them as a motivator and a springboard to go on to success in my life. But my younger brother believed what my father was telling us. And I just, you know, it was just a perfect example for this first passage when I read it in the course, in your text, that I already had an example of exactly that in my life. If you don't believe the messages that you're getting, you just think the person, you know, is seeing something incorrectly or coming from a place of their own identity, and you just wipe it off. I mean, if somebody walked up to me and said, you're the tallest, fattest black man I've ever seen, I just think the person needs glasses or a therapist. I wouldn't find any of that. But if they said the tallest, blackest, fat man who can't sing, part of my heart would be pinged on that because I know I can't sing. Because that's one of the messages I got from my mother, and apparently it was one of my inner doubts about my abilities, and I bought into it, so now I sing like a duck quack. So anyway, I'm going to let go with that idea. So thank you so much for letting me speak, and thank you again for what you said. You were absolutely.
Thanks, Lisa and Carmen. Carmen, you and I should join together sometime and do our singing. I think it could be pretty funny. If yours is as funny as mine. Okay, here we go. 30S, bracket, tell Bill that his slip about Rivet should be noted. Some slips reach consciousness from the unchrist-controlled subconscious and betray a lack of love. Close bracket. We're moving into page 21. 30T. But others, slips, come from the superconscious, which is in communion with God, and which can also break into consciousness. So we have two going on there. Here you go, Doug.
Well, first off, the rivet, I believe, was a typing mistake Bill made when he trying to type river and ended up typing rivet. And precisely what the significance to him was at the time, I either don't know or I can't remember. But what comes next is really quite significant. And it's about slips or Freudian slips, where we type something or say something or read something a little different than what we meant to or what was written. And some of these come from the uncontrolled subconscious, the unchrist-controlled subconscious, and betray a lack of love. But others, Freudian slips, come from the superconscious, which is in communion with God, and which can also break into consciousness. So we're being told here that our consciousness is vulnerable to, quote, break-ins, by both the unchrist-controlled subconscious earthbound thoughts, which betray a lack of love, or by the superconscious, which is that part of our being which is in communion with God and can also break into consciousness. And of course, in the communication and the communion with Jesus, which occurs when we ask, it is that superconscious level that we connect to. And through that superconscious level, the divine breaks into conscious awareness. And then this gets even more interesting. Top of page 21, folks. What about sex? Well, we're getting there. We're getting there. Lisa, you have your hand up.
Yes, but it's not about sex. It's a bit about what you were just talking about. The way that I could explain this for myself and whatever is how it's happened in my life is I would be talking and something would come out and I'd be like, whoa, what was that? And then because it felt kind of not clean, something was not right about it, it would actually stay now in my mind, and that's perfect because then I can, you know, well, before when I wasn't asking for correction, it was just plain embarrassing, and then I felt all kinds of insecurity about it. But then when I was healing and healing of the Holy Spirit, then it was, well, what was that, you know, and I'd like to know what the truth is about that. And then the other one would be where I would be sharing with something, with somebody, or sharing in a room or something, then something would come out, and I would be like, huh, you know, and then I'd be like, oh my God, and then I would have, like, it would just break out into this aha. I'd be like, oh my God, and I would be sitting there, and it would just literally, it would break into consciousness, you know, from super conscious, and totally, like, sit with me for a while afterwards, and it would just, like, oh, you know, like, just like the light went on, you know, something broke through, and I was able to see something, and it was just, it would be huge, you know, and so both of them are actually very helpful, because if there is a slip and it comes out, I actually get to hear what I'm really thinking about something if I don't know, you know? And then on the other side, if it comes out, you know, sideways, it's like literally where God goes, oh yeah, by the way, here, you know? Like, Holy Spirit's like, yeah, here, you know, you need to hear this, you know? And it just comes out, and you're like, oh my God, wow, you know? So paying attention to thought and the source of it, and for me, it's really how it feels that can clue me in quickly as to whether or not it's the truth or not, whether or not it's coming from a subconscious belief, a lie, or whether or not it's true. If it's true, there'll be a lot of peace and a God high with it. I will get like this, ha, and you know, so I totally love those, you know. But grown to appreciate, not necessarily love, but appreciate the Freudian slips. You know, I get to hear what I'm really thinking, you know, and question it with the Holy Spirit.
Okay, one more rivet. As I just posted on the net for those, or on the board for those watching it, appears to relate to a comment that we find on page 31, 10 pages later than this, which leads to some questions about whether the sequence of material as we've received it was actually the sequence in which Helen received it and wrote it down. But the following, the following is in relation to question about sex. Tell Bill that one more river is related to sex. We might even explain it to him as a tidal wave, a term which he will understand. You won't, which is rather interesting. Rivets are bolts that unite two things. Yeah, they're kind of a bolt. One more rivet, one more rivet. Rivet link connection? I'm not entirely sure exactly what's going on with that one, but apparently Bill did. So, Bill was riveted. Yes, he definitely was. All right. And this takes us to T1B30U, top page 21, and take it away, Deborah.
bracket rivet, was an expression of a soul gaining enough strength to request freedom from prison that will ultimately demand it. 30B. Special revelation for Helen Schuckman. Well, that looks like there's a broken sentence here. I hope I'm in the right spot. 30V, special revelation from Helen Schuckman. There was no period in there. So we go to 30W. You are wholly lovely, a perfect shaft of pure light. Before your loveliness, the stars stand transfixed and bow to the power of your will. 30X. What do children know of their creation except that their creator, what their creator tells them? 30Y. You were created above the angels because your role involves creation as well as protection. 30Z. You who are in the image of the Father need bow only to Him, before whom I kneel with you. 30AA. Okay, it says 30AA here. That doesn't make sense. Okay. Oh yeah, it does now. Okay. 30AA. Note, this revelation was permitted because you did not project onto Bill the blame for your omission to ask me if you should transcribe the notes. The fact that he should have done so is from your own admission. Riva Doug.
Yeah, this is just such a beautiful little section. It begins with a little more explanation about the rivet as an expression of a soul gaining enough strength to request freedom from prison. And noting that the soul will ultimately demand, not just request, that freedom. And then we move into a special revelation for Helen. Which is one of the number that show up. And basically is an affirmation of her of her loveliness before which the stars stand transfixed. Quite remarkable. And the explanation is the revelation was permitted or became possible because she did not project blame onto Bill for her own omission to ask if the note should be transcribed. Okay. We're now in the middle of page 21 and about to get into some more material from the notes, which is quite interesting stuff. All right, Deborah.
We're on 30AB. Thanks for blessing him with a miracle rather than cursing him with projection. 30AC. Note further, he needn't feel concerned about it either. So he forgot? Is that... Oh. Not sure if there was a word missing. No, sorry, forgot. It happens all the time until the habit of asking becomes involuntary. You know, I really like that thanking. For blessing him with a miracle rather than cursing him with projection. I think I'm going to thank myself every time I feel the miracle and where I feel I haven't cursed someone with a projection. One, Jonathan, check your bank book. He said he would find it at home in the leather folder. Not there? Go back. Doug, take the mic.
Okay, I just wanted to stress here. The T1B30AC, note further, he needn't feel concerned about it either, his forgetting. So he forgot. So what? It happens all the time. Until the habit of asking becomes involuntary. Now that's a really, really important line, because it tells us that the habit of asking can become involuntary, or essentially habitual. So we don't have to stop and pause all the time to think, oh, should I ask? Oh, maybe I better ask. We just start off by asking because we get really bored with the results of not asking. Now, in this next segment from the notes, which was omitted from the urtext, we start off with Jonathan, which is the name Helen used for her husband, Louis. And the writing is, some of it is in point form, it's not perfect sentences, it's a little difficult to make out, but it does bring up a couple of very important points about Helen's revelatory experience. So it's worth wading through, even though it's not perfect prose by any means.
So I'm starting at 30ACM1. Jonathan, check a bank book. He said he would find it at home in a leather folder. Not there. Call back. No, want to begin your revelation. Now call, but just ask him gently to look in. There's a bunch missing in there. Again. Found it among a lot of letters. Don't know how they got there. 30ACN2. Blessed are you with Mary as the mother of the children. Blessed are you with Mary as the mother of the children. Put in insert now, which I did. Then I asked for forgiveness for having thrown away all the money, but he said, it's all right. You lived in scarcity then, but now you are forgiven, so you live in abundance. There is no longer any need to throw anything away or to want for anything either. Is that saying that Helen and Mary were one? There you go, Doug.
Well, blessed are you with Mary as the mother of the children. Yeah, there is a definite suggestion there of some kind of comradeship, at least. What I want to draw attention to is the bracketing issue here. The loss of a bank book and a check. He said he would find it at home. I think this means Jesus told Helen he, Louis, would find it at home in the leather folder. It's not there? Call back? No. And I think it's Jesus saying, I want to begin your revelation. Now call, but just ask him gently to look in, and I can't read that word in the notes, look in someplace again, where he found it among a lot of letters. And then we move into Helen saying she asked forgiveness for having thrown away all the money. But he said, presumably Jesus, it's all right, you lived in scarcity then, but now you're forgiven, so you live in abundance. There is no longer any need to throw anything away or want for anything either. Now, there is so much talk about manifesting abundance in various spiritual circles, including course groups, that I really think we should look at this and what it's saying. You lived in scarcity, or the belief in scarcity, or scarcity-mindedness then. So, that's why you experienced scarcity. And the way you manifested it was by throwing money away. But now you are forgiven, and presumably know it, so you live in abundance. There's no longer any need to throw anything away, or to want for anything either. Which tells me that the experience of abundance or scarcity comes to us based on what we need, or think we need, which is based on what we believe. And if we think we're guilty, we believe in the reality of guilt, then we think we're not deserving, so there's a good chance we're going to experience scarcity as a punishment for what we believe is our guilt. When forgiveness is recognized or received, and we know we're not guilty, then there's no longer any need to throw anything away or to want for anything, so the experience would not manifest. That's how I read that one. And I think that that's, in terms of Helen's own experience, a very important illustration of the way causation works in terms of the experience of either scarcity or abundance. And now we get into some really interesting little stuff here. T1B30AC, again, this is from the notes, material omitted from the air text.
Soron 830AC, M3. Infant Christ reference or child Christ. Behold the handmaid of the Lord. Be it done unto me according to thy will. Egocentric is right. I do not need another physical mother, and why she was the only one who conceived without any lack of love. But I told you before that many are born which have not been reborn. I mentioned to you and Bill in connection with your own parents. If there is an epidemic, with your own parents. And then 30 AC M4, omit, have one now and a booster if there is an epidemic. Dr. Damrosch and Dr. Wise agree on this. Go ahead, Doug. Oops. Mic off.
Okay, that last line. Well, we're worrying, Helen's worrying about a flu shot. The previous paragraph here, I think, is really quite interesting. Behold the handmaid of the Lord, be it done unto me according to thy will, which I believe is I don't think it's a biblical quote. I think it is from a common Catholic prayer, which I've heard, but I'm not familiar with. My background is not Catholic. But it relates to Mary's response to the angel who appeared to her at the point where she became pregnant with Jesus. And then Jesus responds to Helen's thinking of this parallel with Mary, the mother of Jesus, and perhaps fancying herself in that kind of role. Egocentric is right. I do not need another physical mother. And mine, she was the only one who conceived without any lack of love. But, here's the explanation of the children and the mother. I told you before, many are born which have not been reborn. I mentioned it to you and Bill in connection with your own parent. And then, that page just stopped right there. I mean, the sentence is not finished. The word does not seem to be finished. The rest of the page is blank. But the illustration of parenthood and motherhood here, we're being told, is Helen's role and Bill's role in response to the many who are born, already physically incarnated, that is, which have not been reborn, referring to the biblical statement attributed to Jesus that a man must be born again, second birth, rebirth, to inherit the kingdom of heaven, or to recognize the kingdom of heaven. And Bill and Helen here are being given an assignment to help in that rebirth, as opposed to bearing children in a physical sense. Yeah, Carmen, not reborn in spirit. And so that, I think, is what the previous line about blessed are you with Mary as the mother of the children, Helen is being essentially commissioned to parent or nurture people who need to be reborn.
Okay, carrying on here at 30 AD. Bracket, Helen Schuckman meeting with Dr. Wise and Dr. Damrosch. Dr. D permitted an opportunity for questioning in his capacity as chairman of the flu board for asking Rebill's flu shot. This was an example of how miracles should work. You did not jump into the question yourself And even though you did rush for the phone on Red's advice, you exerted no pressure on Bill's reluctance. Close bracket. Page 22. 38. This gave me a chance to let you leave it to the real expert, whom I sent to answer the question. 31A. Miracles are examples of right thinking. Reality, contact at all levels becomes strong and accurate, thus permitting correct delineation or intra and interpersonal boundaries. As a result, the doer sees the truth as God created it, is meant by the point on perspective adjustment. I like that one. 32. A miracle is a correction factor introduced into false thinking by me. Mike Doug.
Okay, I just wanted to note the function of miracle as correction in both these paragraphs. Miracles are examples of right thinking. Reality contact at all levels becomes strong and accurate at all levels, which would include the physical consciousness level, thus permitting correct delineation of intra and interpersonal boundaries. Now, that too is a fascinating concept. What is delineation of intrapersonal and interpersonal boundaries? Those would be boundaries within ourselves, between levels of the psyche, presumably, and between persons, interpersonal boundaries. As a result, the doer of the miracle sees the truth as God created it. Fascinating. And the miracle is a correction factor introduced into false thinking by me. Me being Jesus there. So we see that the miracle, we've been told before that a precondition for a miracle is lack of fear, even if it's only momentary. But when it goes to work, the miracle not only energizes both giver and receiver, it acts as a corrective on misperceptions within ourselves and between ourselves and other people. And Carmen has her hand up. Go.
Thank you, Doug, for your patience. Thank you, everybody, for your patience. I see a tie-in between the section where he's talking about the incident with the flu shot and the doctor. There was some pressure being put on Bill and Helen. Natural tendency, like the miracle worker's tendency, is to be helpful. And what Jesus was saying was she kind of stepped back just for an instant and allowed him to provide the real expert, that whatever Helen would have put in there would have been probably intended as helpful, but it may not have been exactly how Bill could have heard what he needed to hear. And by her hesitating to take action and fix it, as was her impulse, she instead did hesitate for just a moment and then allowed Jesus to provide the proper answer that Bill could hear with love instead of with fear, which apparently would have been his reaction and Helen done what she was feeling she had to. So I wanted to tie that in with the Bikers for Christ story. It's sometimes the miracle is not going to come through us as individuals, and the truth is that if we give that instant to the Holy Instant, to the Holy Spirit, we are seeing the truth, that the help will come in the direction where it will be best received. And I just want to say thank you.
So as you were talking there, Carmen, I was getting the sense, which I have noted numerous times in my life, that if I don't know what to do, if I am asking and I'm getting nothing, or if I just suddenly stop myself in the moment and not knowing why I'm stopping myself in the moment, I think that's just that perfect opportunity for the miracle to happen because the other person is not being encouraged to shut down by whatever is coming from my mouth. If there's that openness that can just continue to open. You're laughing, Doug. Okay, I'm going to carry on here. I'm going to put the link up. We're on starting 32B. It acts as a catalyst, shaking up erroneous perception and snapping it into place. This corrective factor places man under the atonement principle where his perception is healed. Until this has occurred, perception of the divine order is impossible. True depth perception becomes possible only at the highest order of perceptual integration. Here you go, Doug.
Okay, I just want to point out that we have here another example of uprooting or disorientation. The miracle acts as a catalyst, shaking up erroneous perceptions. And I think many of us have probably experienced a certain shaking up when miracles enter into our experience. But without that correction factor, perception of the divine order is impossible. True depth perception becomes possible only at the highest order of perceptual integration. And in relation to questions about purification that came up in previous reading, I think this directly pertains. We're getting more details on what the purification entails and involves. Yeah, true depth perception, we might be think of that as deep perception. We also might think of that as depth perception in the sense of, you know, stereoscopic capacity to tell how far things are away in terms of sorting levels and understanding precisely how things relate to each other. Could refer to interdimensional perception. I think the notion of true perception, accurate, correct, proper, true perception at all levels is the concept that is being pursued here. Okay, now we get into the spiritual eye, which also relates to depth perception at a spiritual level.
Yummy indeed, Lisa. So we are on page 22, text 1B, 32C. The spiritual eye is the mechanism of miracles because what the spiritual eye perceives is truth. The spiritual eye perceives both the creations of God and the creations of man. Among the creations of man, it can also separate the true from the false by its ability to perceive totally rather than selectively. It thus becomes the proper instrument for reality testing, which always involves the necessary distinction between the true and the false. 33A. The miracle dissolves error because the spiritual eye identifies error as false or unreal. This is the same as saying light, darkness automatically disappears. Page 23, 33B. Doug, take it away.
Okay, I just wanted to say here that...
Maybe you won't take it away. I don't know whether you're trying to pick up the mic. I'll let it go again in case you are.
Yeah, I'm trying. Did I succeed? Yes. The spiritual eye here is a metaphor for depth perception, true perception, corrected perception. which is the proper and even necessary instrument for reality testing. And it draws our attention to the necessary distinction between discerning the true and the false, recognizing what's true and what isn't. And the miracle dissolves error because the spiritual eye recognizes or identifies error as false or unreal. And this is a nice contrast with the previous discussion of demons and Lucifer and possession and various fearful things. The error is simply unreal. It's not dangerous. It's not evil power. Though we can be vulnerable to it insofar as we are lacking in love. And then the metaphor is used. This is the same as saying that by seeing light, darkness automatically disappears. When love enters, fear leaves. There is no room for fear in love. And the parallel here, of course, is between darkness and error, light and love. Okay, so this is the top of page 23, P1B 33B.
Darkness is the lack of light. It does not have unique properties of its own. It is an example of the scarcity fallacy from which only error can proceed. 33C. Truth is also 33CN1. Bracket no, Helplin, not pregnant or fat, scarcely leads to overeating and false pregnancy notions. Abundance eliminates these false drives. Close bracket. Those who perceive and acknowledge that they have everything have no need for driven behavior of any kind. Helen Schuckman has other personal material related to this regarding pregnancy. 34. Miracles are a blessing from parents to children. This is just another way of phrasing the previous point about from those who have more to those who have less. Children do not belong to parents, but they do need to share their greater abundance. If they are deprived, their perception becomes distorted. When this occurs, the whole family of God, or the sonship, is impaired in its relationships. Take the mic, Carmen.
I'm going to start by asking you forgiveness for jumping in so much, but the thing about driven behavior is very, very key. The studies have proven that 95% of our behavior is unconsciously done. A lot of our addictions are driven behaviors, and I believe the purification process is necessary because so much of our behaviors in mundane life are these driven behaviors. They're on autopilot. And that's what purification process is about addressing. And I think it's a very key phrase, and I don't think it made it into the final version for FIP. But driven behavior seems to be a psychological term, and a lot of the psychology was edited out of the FIP. And I think it's very important for us to look at that sentence and to understand that so much of our behavior is driven unconsciously or subconsciously. And to understand just, you know, how far-reaching the ramifications of the purification process are, we may address some driven behavior in a specific instance, say with a partner or in a work situation, and then realize that once we can address that driven behavior in one instance, by getting to the root cause of it, then we see that that driven behavior has just either modified tremendously and weakened or has disappeared altogether. And we're now becoming conscious in our choices about behavior, and I think that's a really important phrase for us to look at and understand that. Sorry for interrupting. Sorry.
Well, that's an excellent point, Kermit, and I'm glad you stressed it. Driven behavior is, of course, that kind of thing that comes from the subconscious, or false drives rather than from the superconscious, and generally isn't subject to real conscious review. And I think most compulsive or addictive behavior certainly falls into that category. But look at the explanation here. Those who perceive and acknowledge that they have everything have no need for driven behavior of any kind. It's only when we don't perceive and acknowledge that we already have everything that driven behavior arises, because it tends to come from the subconscious belief that I lack. And in order to fill my lack, which is a fear, some kind of driven behavior, acquisitiveness, or this is discussed elsewhere, various kinds of, from the, you know, the horse racing addict is mentioned as an example of driven behavior. But it all comes from the perception and belief that we don't have everything already. So some kind of compulsion to get what we think we don't have arises from the subconscious. And you're quite right. It's usually something that people simply have a great deal of difficulty controlling at a conscious level, because that belief is profound and deep, that belief in lack. And Lisa, you have got your hand up. Here we go.
I just wanted to thank you, Carmen, for pointing out the word driven, because we were reading it so fast, I totally skipped over it. You know, it's so interesting, because of all the addictions that I had, and believe me, I had several, food was the numero uno one. And so when it came to, like, trying to diet or do anything around that, it made it worse. You know, it's like you can't have and more lack and more scarcity and more fear. The more fear, the more food. The more fear, the more food. The more I tried to control it, the more out of control it would get. And it was so baffling to me until I learned what was really going on and healed that. And it was so interesting, because in the Course in Miracles, in a huge section, I mean, it's all over the Course in Miracles where it talks about this, but really specific points this concept in when it talks about idols and what idols are for. And if you really, really got what you're seeking, you're just seeking in the wrong place, that you're projected out into the illusion and seeking your salvation in the illusion because you believe you don't have, that you're not whole, you know. And so it's so perfect that even if we didn't see it here, it's still in the Course and it's still very clear. So thanks for letting me share.
Well, thanks for that, Lisa. Yeah, that really is an important line, and it's going to be discussed in greater detail in subsequent pages. And I would just also point out, there's an interesting little aside there, that Helen has some other personal material related to this regarding pregnancy material, which was not shared. We don't have access to whatever that was. And then once again, we move into the miracles or blessings from parents to children, and that notion of parenting or nurturing associated with the performance of miracles from those who have more temporarily to those who have less. Okay, and that I'm just reading it here. Brings us to the end of T1B34 and the start of T1B34B. Lee writes, alcoholics say that they thought they had a bottle-sized hole in their being. Yeah. That would be a good metaphor for describing driven behavior.
Yep.
All right. And Christian, you have your hand up. All right, go.
Doug, thank you. I've just written to Doug Martin asking
not constantly preserved, they don't include the great big secret. I think it's important to realize with the ego that it doesn't just come from lack. So I'm searching for things outside of myself because I've invented lack. It's not really that I believe in lack, it's my belief. It's that I've invented lack because I want to kill the Son of God in me. And because I want to kill and overcome him, I'm not necessarily seeking for idols because of some mistaken belief. You know, that's at the surface, but really the belief in lack is really the attempt to kill God or God's Son. And so really, it's quite deliberate. It's not just a deluded fantasy of lack. It's a deluded fantasy of lack driven by the desire to kill, which is quite deliberate and quite deliberately chosen. And that's my understanding of why A Course in Miracles comes about in our dream, as it were, for the correction, because the undoing of that would be impossible without a mind trap. It would be literally impossible. Because you'd always be believing that there was something out there that you wanted, and you would think that it was coming from desire for what is out there rather than desire for death. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Christian. And I think that's a really good metaphor to remind ourselves of, and it's used in the Course a number of times, kill and murder, those words. And I don't think, generally speaking, it's talking about literal criminal acts of murder so much as the idea that guilt implies punishment. The belief in the existence of guilt, however unconscious or ill-formed, implies the belief in punishment. And what do we do with the guilty? We kill it. We murder it. We exterminate it. We punish it. We do something to expunge it at the ego level. And the idea of killing the Son of God, well, the Son of God, the true holiness that we are, is terrifying to the ego because it implies literally the death of the ego. And from that ego perception, then, the Son of God is a severe threat who must be killed. Because the Son of God, when manifested, would deny guilt and deny any semblance of reality or credibility to the ego, implying, in essence, its undoing. And the ego knows that very well. And so that gives birth to beliefs in inadequacy, that I don't have, that I'm missing something, because I'm guilty, I don't deserve it, which leads to driven behavior, which is a little bit like a child having a temper tantrum when being told he can't play with my razor blade. It's attack. And in essence, the will to kill. I mean, the instinct there is murder, even if it never manifests as physical aggression. All right, being drunk on love is a good thing, writes Carmen, and I don't think you're going to get any argument here. I'm just going to point out we've got 7 minutes left, so we need to think about winding down at this point. And we are on 34, did we read 34B? I think you've got your finger on it, Deborah, so take it away.
Ultimately, every member of the family of God must return. The miracle calls to him to return because it blesses and honors him, even though he may be absent in spirit. The 34, 35A. The miracle acknowledges all men as your brothers and mine. a way of perceiving the universal mark of God in them. 35B. Bracket. Tell Bill that this is the true strawberry mark of brotherhood. This is just a sign of special concern for him because he keeps worrying about this. Close bracket. Doug.
Okay, once again, this material is so densely packed. I mean, practically every phrase is worthy of discussion. So we have here, first of all, ultimately every member of the family of God must return. The universality of salvation, this is a required course, only the time you take it is optional. Eventually you will, and eventually you will return, and the wholeness of the sonship will not be fully realized until we are all returned. The miracle is a call to return, because it blesses him and honors him, even though he may be absent in spirit. And this reminds me of the biker story. Okay, the guy was absent in spirit, but he was present, and was honored, and heard the call to return, and received it in just the language he needed and could accept from just the people he could trust to hand it to him. At just the moment, his spirit actually began to be present. And the miracle acknowledges all men as your brothers and mine, Jesus speaking. It's a way of perceiving the universal mark of God in them. And then we get this curious strawberry mark of brotherhood, which is a signal to Bill that only Bill will understand. And I don't know what the strawberry mark is. Does anybody else? Did you ever manage to track that one down, Cameron? Carmen? All right. I don't know that one, and that brings us to the end of page 23, the last paragraph, and T1B 35C. Deborah.
We might add that his false idea about his own exclusion from universal love is fallacious in your terms and arrogant in his. His real specialness does not stem from exclusion, but from inclusion. All my brothers are special. He should stop interpreting this as, oh, this is ridiculous. Oh, my God, Bill. He's so sweet. I guess I'll carry on. We're on page 24. 35D. Tell him that the implied lack of love that his version contains is way off the mark. And this is the level of right thinking entirely. He must heal his perception in this respect. He must work a miracle on behalf of himself. If here, bracket, see the point about miracles as a perception corrector, close bracket, before he can effect miracles as creative energizers, which they are.
Okay, all right, I'm looking in three directions here at once. Bill's idea that all means all except Bill, which is ridiculous. But Bill clearly had a problem with this, and Helen is being told to tell him that the implied lack of love is way off the mark, misses the level of right thinking entirely, and he must heal his perception in this respect. He must work a miracle on behalf of himself here, and see the point about miracles as perception corrector, which we read earlier this afternoon, before he can effect miracles as creative energizers, which they are. And this again pertains to the purification. this is part of the purification being designated specifically for Bill's particular problem, but it's a problem I suspect many of us have, and it's not entirely unique to Bill. And we're now at 5:58, 5:59 by my clock, with 1 minute to go. So stopping there at the top of page 24, T1B35B, which I'll write down so I remember where we stopped. I'd just like to thank everybody for your participation and your comments and on board and verbally. It's been a great experience. I love doing this with you all. And Deborah has her hand up. Take it away, Deborah.
Hi, Amy. I just wanted to say goodbye, though, because I got to get going back to work. And I just want to give y'all and the entire Sunshine all my love. You can do with it what you will. So bye, everyone. Thanks very much.
Goodbye, Deborah. Yeah, Deborah has to rush off to work right now. So have a good work. And thank you, everyone. And I'm going to go have supper now. But it's been a delight, as usual. God bless you.
Thank you, Doug. We had a lady here last night. Julia Crow. Anyway, she's written a book about Phil, so I wouldn't be surprised if she didn't have some understanding of the strawberry mark in the sense that if he had one, not the symbolism, which I think is fairly obvious. That was Carol Howe. Thank you, Don. She might be aware. Then again, maybe it's Bill's business. But thank you for that.